Thank you. You may be seated. Good morning. We are here for argument in CV 240936, Azuli versus CBAC. As you may know, we record and live stream these proceedings, so please give your name and the name of your client when you begin. You have a maximum of 20 minutes per side, although you are not required to use all of your time. However, we do require you to keep track of your time, and the clocks on the podium reflect your total remaining minutes, and you are responsible for keeping track of any time you'd like to reserve. Please keep in mind we've read the briefing, study the record, and conference this case. Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Abraham Kaplan, and I represent Mr. Azuli in this appeal. And going exactly to that, Your Honors, the record of this case. The record of this case contains first the original motion for summary judgment brought by CBAC, the opposition from plaintiffs, and the July 2023 hearing. Then there was an order denying summary judgment in entirety. Then again, a motion to reconsider, an opposition, and a hearing. And then another order from the court, completely overturning its prior order. So the record in this case is composed of that entire record, all the briefing in that matter, all the transcripts in that matter, and all the evidence presented in that case in this matter. And both counsels in this case on appeal were not the counsels in the lower court. So to come before this court and present that record, I made the attempt to gather all the evidence to present it in a succinct way before this court. And, Your Honor, there are some documents that were presented in this case that are crucial to this appeal that appellee's counsel are claiming is new evidence in the case. But as I presented to this court, there are no new documents in this case. Everything was at one point presented on appeal, and the citations are throughout my reply brief, Your Honor. And both counsels admit that evidence presented to the Superior Court at the time of the motion is included in the record. So going back to the overall standard, it bears repeating. In order for a party to get summary judgment, no genuine issue of a material fact must exist. A reasonable person cannot find for the defendant. And all inferences must go toward Mr. Azuli in this case. Now, the contract in this case is one of the primary documents and must be examined carefully by this court. We're dealing with the close of escrow clauses, the financing provisions, the remedies provisions, and the most important issue before this court is after CBAC served a demand for a cure on a lack of financing between May 13th, May 14th, and 15th, did Mr. Azuli provide a financing cure? So the question in this case is how to interpret the contract. Now the court, without much analysis, called the conditional loan approval requirement not as a requirement to have PTD conditions, but just in general to have no conditions. And looking at the contract, that's not what the contract says, Your Honors. There's a specific requirement that an approval has to be without PTD conditions, but conditions are allowed to exist. So the question for this court...
Counsel, does the contract define the difference between PTD conditions and general conditions?
It does not, Your Honor. Which is an important analysis, because if the contract does not have a defined term that on its face is not apparent from the contract, then as a matter of law, it's ambiguous. Now, I'm not raising this for the first time on appeal in order to try to have a specific win on this issue, Your Honors. It's part of the court's de novo review. when the court examines the contract to decide whether or not the superior court analyzed it correctly, one of the questions is it an ambiguous contract or not? And in this case, because extrinsic evidence needs to be looked at to decide whether or not it's ambiguous, automatically, as a matter of law, it's ambiguous.
Does the contract indicate what type of notice Mr. Azzulli was required to provide to demonstrate that he cured the breach? In other words, does the contract indicate whether or not an email from Mr. Azzulli himself was sufficient?
So, Your Honor, I would argue that that's also a flexible term in the contract. The financing clause in Section 2B states that not later than 3 days prior to the close of escrow date, buyers shall either provide a notice of loan approval without PTT conditions and date of receipt of closing disclosures from lender. So, Your Honor, it specifically says that the buyer is allowed to be the one that provides it as opposed directly from the lender. So, on its face, the contract just says we need to get assurance that the lender has approval without PTT conditions. And now, Your Honor's going to directly to the evidence of this case. On May 14th, 2021, the seller in this case, CBAC, received a conditional loan approval from Angel Oak. It was through Mr. Azzulli, but it came from Angel Oak. And on its face, a conditional loan approval does not violate the provisions of Section 2 in the contract, because it doesn't say it's with or without PTD conditions. So this court has to take a step back in its de novo review and say, looking at the May 14th, 2021 loan approval, does that meet the conditions of the contract? And Your Honor, at the very least, it's a dispute of fact. Because CBAC, their entire argument in the lower court and on the Court of Appeals, is arguing that condition number 5, Your Honors, in that May 14th, 2021 loan approval is what violates the requirement to have no PTD conditions. And Your Honor, this is an addendum number 3 in appellant's briefing. And in condition number 5, it states, the closing date per the contract of May 14th, 2021, if actual closing is after this date, all parties must fully execute an extension at prior to closing. Now, I don't understand how the Superior Court found no genuine dispute of fact that this condition number 5 is a PTD condition. There is simply an incomplete factual record on this point.
Let me ask you about the what was before the Superior Court. In Mr. Azzulli's response to summary judgment, Mr. Azzulli attached 15 exhibits, A through O. In his ruling, the Superior Court stated that the exhibits don't support Mr. Azzulli's assertions. The exhibits listed by the plaintiff as supporting this claim do not do so, is what the court said. And then the court proceeded to discuss exhibits A through L. The court made no reference to exhibits M, N, or O, exhibit N being the expert report. Did the court just overlook those exhibits? What explanation, if any, do you have for the fact that those are not referenced in the court's ruling?
So I do think the court erred and simply forgot exhibits, Your Honors. And even looking at the record in this case, In the Superior Court's original summary judgment order denying motion for summary judgment by CBAC, the court found, the court understand the plaintiff's argument to be that did he not cure the breach allowed by the cure notice? So the court said, we recognize this is Mr. Azzulli's argument. And then the court found explicitly, the court finds that this set of circumstances raises at least one significant material fact. Did Mr. Azzulli cure the breach within the three-day period? So in the original summary judgment order, the court recognized it was a dispute of fact. Now, the evidence in front of the court was Angel Oak's May 14th, 2021 conditional loan approval that we argue at the very least creates an issue of fact for a jury to say,
Was that document, though, that document given to the court in response to the motion for summary judgment. Is that one of the documents, Exhibit A through O, that was submitted?
So the conditional loan approval documents were submitted by CBEC in its motion for summary judgment, and in its motion to reconsider, specifically Exhibit C, the latest conditional loan approval document from Angel Oak was included. So without a doubt, the May 14th, 2021 loan approval, conditional loan approval from Angel Oak was in front of this court. And the court just didn't analyze why it felt number five must be a PTD condition. But importantly, Your Honors, I also want to go back to the May 15th, 2021 loan approval that was received in this case. Now, this is an important document. This is from the loan officer submitted to CBEC on the last day that the cure was allowed to be presented on May 15th, 2021, and explicitly states that the loan is approved without PTD conditions.
Are you saying this is the document from Mr. Becker, the email from Mr. Becker?
So this is addendum number four, which is an email from Mr. Becker and sent to CBEC. Now, I'd like to spend just a few moments explaining how this is found in the record. And I agree, Your Honor, it's a disorganized record because of the multiple motions and because evidence was presented at the summary judgment hearing on a Zoom screen in front of the court. And the addendum number four contains a loan status update signed by the loan officer saying it was without PTD conditions. It's an addendum number four in appellate's briefing. CBEC's counsel is arguing that this document was never presented to the Superior Court. Now, appellants agree it was not presented in the exhibits filed prior to summary judgment, but at the summary judgment hearing, it was presented to the court, and it was one of the main topics of summary judgment was whether or not this LSU loan approval from Michael Becker cured the breach. So it was absolutely within the record. And it is apparent that in the judge's original summary judgment order, it considered that exhibit and it found there's a dispute of fact in this case. But in its later summary judgment order, they appear to have forgotten the exhibit. Now, a superior court can forget something, but this court, in its de novo review, looks at all facts present and decides whether or not there's a dispute of fact. And with this document that this court is allowed to view because it's in the record, because it was presented to the Superior Court, it is...
How is it in the record? Is there a transcript of the summary judgment hearing in the record?
Absolutely.
Where is that?
The transcript was ordered, provided to the appellate court and cited by both parties in this case, in its appellant briefing.
My review of the record didn't include a transcript of that hearing.
Of the summary judgment hearing?
Right. Same here.
Okay. Well, I'll reserve time in rebuttal, Your Honor, and I'll address it. In this case, there was an initial appeal that was brought and dismissed as untimely, and then an appeal again on the same record. It might have existed in a prior record, in the first appeal, but I will confirm on rebuttal that the transcript is ordered and presented to the appellate court.
There is record 147. There is a notice of a transcript order. So I think it appears to have been ordered.
Right.
But we don't see it in the record, the transcript itself.
Okay, Your Honor, I'll reserve time in rebuttal and address it. But it is important that both parties in this case cited to the transcript and are agreeing that it's in the record, and we'll make sure that the appellate court has it in its review, Your Honors. So with these two documents, the May 14th document from Angel Oak and the May 15th document from Michael Becker, each on their own show that there was a loan approval given to CBEC, and it creates a question of dispute of fact, at the very least, Your Honors, whether or not that cured the deficiency notice.
Assuming we agree with you in reverse summary judgment, what does that do on the list pendens issue?
So the list pendens was originally decided early on in the proceedings, and it was removed. And then later on, there was an additional statutory penalty that was put on Mr. Azzulli. And we're making two arguments, Your Honor. Number one, that there is no frivolous support that can be found that Mr. Azzulli filed a frivolous list pendens based on the record before the court. And number two, Your Honor, that under the clear requirements under the law, the only party that can bring that statutory claim is an owner or beneficiary holder of title. And in this case, CBEC admits that by the time the list pendens was filed, they had already deeded over the property to the new buyer, Your Honor.
Is it true the list pendens was filed the day after the transaction closed on the property?
So the record shows it was filed the same day.
Okay.
And again, it wasn't a public record that the property was deeded over. It was a warranty deed with a promissory note, which is seller financed. So there's no proof that Mr. Azzulli had any knowledge, and indeed he wouldn't have had knowledge, that two private parties executed a separate transaction. And, Your Honor, importantly, even if something is missing from the record, if there's evidence in the record that shows documents were sent, that hole in the record prevents summary judgment, because all reasonable inferences must go toward Mr. Azzulli. So in this case, if there's evidence that Michael Becker sent a document to CBEC with a loan approval, even if the document somehow was not found in the record, still, is it a reasonable inference to assume that document exists? And in this case, there is a stunted record in the lower court, because CBEC brought summary judgment without getting deposition testimony from Angel Oak. They brought summary judgment without getting deposition testimony from Michael Becker of Interest Home Loans. So they're trying to create an argument for summary judgment while ignoring massive holes in the record. And that's their burden. Their burden is to show that the original 514 notice from Angel Oak was with PTD conditions, and they needed to prove that the document sent in the email from Michael Becker is not an appropriate document to cure. That's their burden, not ours. If there's a hole in the record, all reasonable inferences must go to Mr. Azzulli. I would like to keep the remainder of my time, Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Joseph Pertuswoski, and I represent the appellee, CBEC Enterprises. We talked a lot in the opening brief about the record and the noncompliance with the procedural rules, both in the trial court and in this court, are fatal to Azzulli's appeal. To start, there are new arguments that have been presented to this court that are not allowed to be brought at this court. My friend, he actually referenced an addendum with an LSU attached to it. However, that LSU was never in front of the trial court at the time of the summary judgment hearing.
Wasn't it discussed? I thought I read in the briefing that it was mentioned during oral argument.
It was mentioned during oral argument, as far as I understand from the transcripts. Now, I did reference the transcripts. When I did my answering brief, I believe that they were on the record because they were provided. However, upon review of the record, I never saw those transcripts. So I did include some excerpts from the transcripts in my appendix. However, yes, it was briefly discussed. However, ultimately, the court found that it did not show that there was a cure of Section 2B.
Did that include the expert report? Because I know that the relevant portion of that LSU is reproduced, or at least an image of it is reproduced inside the expert report. Is that not so?
Yes, there is an image of the LSU that is in the unverified, unsigned expert report that was not supported by any affidavits, no declaration. Azzulli himself didn't even sign a declaration to any of the statement of facts.
And did you raise that objection in the trial court?
It was raised in the reply that the expert report specifically was hearsay within hearsay within hearsay.
Well, there was a reference to the expert report being a hearsay report. That
term,
hearsay report, was used. But was there any objection raised to the court considering the expert report?
In the reply, I believe that was an objection to the expert report. The transcripts aren't on the record, and so without having the transcripts on the record, we can't go and see if there was an objection. I don't know off the top of my head, because I didn't memorize the transcript, and it's not in front of the court.
If all there is in the reply is a reference to the report, as the hearsay report says XYZ, the use of the term expert hearsay report by itself does not preserve an objection to the court considering the expert report, does it?
No, but I think that the reply went further. The reply also stated that it was hearsay because it was unsigned, it was unverified, and it was not supported by any affidavit or declaration. And so,
in the reply, there's a specific request to strike that report.
I believe there is, Your Honor.
I know that there isn't an order striking it.
No, there is nothing in the order, but also we're doing a de novo review, and I think this court can look back and say that expert report should have never been used in the first place to even look at, because the rules of evidence under Rule 56 were not followed to controvert any facts that were stated by CBAC.
Well, you just raised an interesting point you said the expert report couldn't be considered. The trial court listed the exhibits that the trial court considered, discussed exhibits A through L, made no reference to exhibits M, N, O. So my question, as I asked opposing counsel, is did the trial court just miss those exhibits?
I don't think that she did. I think that Judge Sinclair looked at the separate statement of facts that were submitted by Azzulli. And in paragraph 31, he states that to prove the cure, which she was only looking at the cure in the motion for reconsideration after she determined she misread an exhibit, they say exhibits A, D through H, and K prove that he cured. And so she looked at A, D through H, and K to see if there was any admissible evidence that would support him curing that notice of cure. And she found that there was no evidence that was admissible and that supports the record to show that he cured, which was the linchpin of everything. Because when it showed that he didn't cure, there was no breach of good faith and fair dealing claim left, and there was...
All right, accepting what you say is true, why doesn't Mr. Azzulli's own email of May 14th, why isn't that enough notice that he's cured, that the agreement doesn't specifically prescribe any particular form of notice? It doesn't say it has to come directly from the lender. It doesn't say any particular verbiage has to be used. Why isn't Mr. Azzulli's email alone enough?
Because it still doesn't show that there was any loan approval, let alone loan approval without PTD conditions. The email itself is just a forwarded email, which makes it hearsay again. And it's not supported by any declaration or affidavit that it's a true and correct copy in their own exhibits.
But where in the agreement does it require him to declare or make some official, file an affidavit saying this is true? I mean, how isn't that sufficient under Section 2, under the financing section of the contract?
Let me clarify. I'm talking about the procedural rule under Rule 56 that you have to bring admissible evidence to controvert statements of facts and arguments, and you have to bring specific arguments with admissible evidence that are supported. And those are done by affidavits and declaration. Mr. Azzulli did not sign any declaration or affidavit in his separate statement of facts or controverting facts.
And you're saying you raised that objection in your reply?
I'm saying that on de novo review, if we're looking at all de novo review, none of that should have been admissible evidence that should be looked at by the court.
But the objection has to be raised in the trial court to give the other party an opportunity to cure the defect or else the objection is waived. Isn't that right?
To an extent, I believe that it was raised that there was no declaration or affidavit. I would have to look back at the record, but I believe on de novo review, when you're looking at what is admissible on the record at the time of the motion for summary judgment, you have to also go back to Rule 56 and see what evidence was admissible on de novo review.
So we don't have to consider we're allowed to consider or we're allowed to entertain objections that were never raised in the trial court, is what you're
I think
saying.
You can yes, in this sense, because you're looking at the record to the motion for summary judgment hearing. And if you're looking to what you're looking at the motion for summary judgment hearing and what is admissible on the record at that time, you can look to see whether or not that evidence is admissible. A lot of the argument in the opening brief was whether or not things were presented and whether they were in front of the court. But the real question is whether or not it's admissible. And without the declarations, without the affidavits, without citations to specific parts of the record, it is inadmissible and cannot be used to prove your point. There are uncontested facts. The uncontested facts, and Rule 56 states, under Rule 56E, it says, when a summary judgment motion is made and supported as provided in this rule, an opposing party may not rely merely on allegations or denials of its own pleading. The opposing party must, by affidavits, or as otherwise provided in the rule, set forth specific facts showing a genuine issue for trial. If the opposing party does not so respond, summary judgment, if appropriate, shall be entered against that party. We didn't have any affidavits. There's no admissible evidence. All we have is a lot of hearsay. We have no custodians of record.
But that objection and a motion to strike has to be made at the trial court, right?
This isn't our appeal or cross appeal, Your Honor. I believe that with de novo review, we can look at what is admissible on the record at the time of the trial court hearing. And upon de novo review, if we can find any reason to affirm the lower court, I believe that it should be affirmed.
All right. And opposing counsel indicates that your client submitted as Exhibit C the conditional loan agreement. So presumably you're agreeing that we can consider that if your client is the one who presented it.
No. I don't believe that any exhibits attached to the motion for reconsideration should be looked at by this court. There's plenty of case law in Arizona that show that exhibits attached to motion for reconsideration are not considered on the appeal.
Even if the motion for reconsideration is granted and that's what's being appealed?
The motion for reconsideration was granted because the judge misread an email thinking that Ms. Cook had canceled the contract on May 14th rather than May 16th. She puts that in her ruling that she misread the email. In the original motion for summary judgment, the declaration by Ms. Cook showed that on May 16th she canceled. So there was a misunderstanding by the court when she originally thought the cancellation happened. She thought it happened prior to the...
Let me just make sure I'm understanding. Your client filed a motion for reconsideration. Your client's motion for reconsideration was granted. That's what's being appealed. And you're telling us we can't consider the exhibits that your client submitted in support of its own motion for reconsideration?
I am saying that the reconsideration was for the motion for summary judgment. The appeal is based off the ruling for the summary judgment, but the exhibits attached to the motion for reconsideration should not be looked at by this court.
The motion for reconsideration is what's being appealed.
Correct, but you can't add new evidence in a motion for reconsideration, Your Honor.
Well, apparently you can because you did and you won.
But the ruling in the motion for reconsideration did not take into effect the new evidence. The motion for reconsideration took into consideration the misreading of the original evidence that was presented to the court at the motion for summary judgment phase, which was that Ms. Cook canceled on May 16th, not May 14th, after the cure period had expired.
Can you cite authority for the proposition that we can't consider attachments to a motion for reconsideration?
Yes, I can. Brookover v. Roberts Enterprises. And that is 215 Arizona 52, 156 P3D 1157. That was in the appellate court in 2007, which says that you cannot consider new arguments. Sorry, let me find.
That applies to new arguments raised by the party that
lost, right? Yes, that's right. That's right. That's for the appellate court. I apologize.
I guess, can you remind me if you cited any of this authority in your briefing?
I did cite it in my briefing. I apologize. I'm looking through all my citations in the briefing, but I know it is in here. I just went over it yesterday. But yes, it is cited in my briefing. I believe it would be, right. So if you look at GM Development Corp, and in fact, this is where it's a little embarrassing. I actually put the wrong citation in my case, but the correct citation is GM Development Corp v. Community America Mortgage Corp, and that's 795 P2D 827, specifically in page 830, where the scope of the appellate court's review on summary judgment is limited to the evidence presented to the trial court when the motion was heard, and the appellate court does not consider any evidence later introduced in the trial of the matter. And that's from GM Development Corp. From, and so there is case law out there that shows that evidence on reconsideration cannot be used to reconsider the motion for summary judgment. All of the evidence was on the record to find the way that the court found at the summary judgment hearing. And I do want to jump back into a little bit of some of the other procedural flaws. And in fact, in the opening brief, I believe that the failure to cite two references on the record, were there any issues, were there any issues that were ruled on, were there any objections raised in their own opening brief, Mr. Azzulli's opening brief, is also fatal to their case. There are case laws out there that state if you don't follow the rules, or if you don't even try to follow the rules, that your arguments should be abandoned and waived. Aside from all that, and I know we've already gone over a lot of it, I want to jump into the contract ambiguity a little bit. The contract ambiguity question, I don't believe I believe that it sticks with the question of law. There was no extrinsic evidence that was used to determine what the interpretation means. There has to be more than one susceptible definition of the term.
What's the definition of the term PTD condition? I mean, I know what the letters stand for, but how do we know if a condition is a PTD condition or not?
They are conditions that need to be met before closing documents can be provided.
That's in the contract?
That's not in the contract. However, it is a term of art in the real estate financing world. We have a plaintiff who is a real estate broker. We have a seller who is a real estate agent. It is a term of art in the real estate industry. If you're looking at ship freighters and you have a contract that states FOB, and you have those ship freighters come into court and one of them argues, I don't know what FOB means, they would be laughed out of court because it is a term of art in the shipping industry, just as PTD conditions is a term of art in the real estate industry.
And what is the evidence in the record that shows that this is a term of art recognized in the industry and here's what the industry understands it to mean?
The evidence is that Mr. Azzulli has has stated that he is a licensed real estate agent. And it is known in the industry that it is a term of art. The definition was proposed and put into the pleading papers so that the trier of fact would understand what PTD conditions was. There was never a dispute.
The trial judge seemed to find significance in the fact that the word conditional appears in the term conditional loan agreement. But your opposing counsel argues that not all conditions are PTD conditions, and the fact that there were conditions to the loan approval doesn't necessarily mean that they were PTD conditions, and it's an issue of fact about whether those conditions were in fact PTD conditions. What's your response?
No, there is no question of fact. The reason being is there's no evidence at all that any conditions were satisfied in the lower court at the summary judgment hearing. The court in front of it had a document that was presented by Azzulli. And that document was a two-page conditional underwriting approval from May 13th. After May 13th, he was still asking. He still did not have any kind of approval. That document was also presented an earlier version from April 22nd in CBAC's separate statement of facts. And it was about a 7-page document. So the only document that the lower court judge had that they could review at the time of the summary judgment hearing was a 2-page document where the second page starts with a number 2 that says a second appraisal review has to be done. But the page before doesn't even have any numbers. And so it's an incomplete document. It's not admissible at the lower court, and it shouldn't be considered. It shouldn't have been considered then, and I don't think it should be considered now.
Counsel, with the time remaining to us, there are a couple of issues that I want to touch on. First is, how is it a violation of the slander of title statute if a person records a list pendants with regard to a specific performance claim?
The fact is that the statute is clear. It is clear that you cannot cloud title that is baseless or groundless. The lower court found in the special action that the Liz pendants was baseless and groundless. That argument was brought in the summary judgment, the original summary judgment, the motion for summary judgment. The Azuli's counsel failed to respond entirely to the 33-420 claim in their response. They waived any defense to the defense that they are now bringing in this court. And
well, we've already established, and you just argued that, you know, if you didn't make objections specific to it, that we have a de novo review. So let's.
Right, but there's also no evidence on the record to show that he was or was not. And so I believe that argument has to be waived at this point.
To show that he was or was not what?
Well, that he had intent or he did not have intent. But I would say that when that claim is waived and not even responded to in any way in the lower court, that bringing a brand new argument here is different from whether the argument was brought in the lower court and responded to or disputed.
Was the Liz pendants quashed because the property had already been sold? Was that the reason?
The Liz pendants was quashed because it was clouding title, and there was no claim at that point. It had already been transferred, yes. And so now it was clouding title on a specific performance claim where they couldn't get the property back because it wasn't in the possession of the person that the Liz pendants was brought against.
Okay, so that's the basis for quashing it, because it was too late.
It was too late, and there was also a letter that was presented, but this isn't evidence, so I don't want to get into it, but it is on the record, I apologize. There was a letter presented to remove the Liz pendants for being wrongful, and the time was given for them to remove the Liz pendants, and it was not prior to the special action.
Is there any evidence in the record, though, that Mr. Azuli knew at the time he recorded the Liz pendants that the property had already been sold?
No, there is not evidence of that. However, there is evidence that he was told that he needs to remove it, was given the statutory time to remove it, and did not before the special action was brought. So under the statute, once you give notice that it is a wrongful Liz pendants, they have to either remove it, or if they keep it, you can bring the special action. The special action was brought after the notice was given. And I'm out of time, Your Honors. I apologize. And we ask that you affirm the summary judgment and award attorney's fees and costs for the cost of this appeal. Thank you.
Your Honors, just briefly, I frankly think it's incredible that a party that brings a motion for summary judgment and asks the court to review evidence to grant that, motion to reconsider, and ask the judge to review evidence in support of the motion to reconsider, will then somehow attempt to exclude that evidence before the appellate court. The court considered all the documents in the motion to reconsider. If they're granting the motion to reconsider, it's opening up the summary judgment motion into additional evidence and proof that was granted. If it was not excluded, it is specifically inside this record that this court not only should consider, but has to consider, frankly, that on 514, Angel Oaks submitted a document that labeled conditional loan approval, but there is absolutely, at the very least, a dispute of fact whether or not it's a full loan approval. Now, appellee's counsel can claim that a PTD condition is known and the definition was assumed, But I think it's pretty clear from the record that the Superior Court judge did not understand in the slightest what a PTD condition is and what a PTF condition is. And the argument to support that is that both orders drafted and ordered by the Superior Court judge just focuses on the words conditional loan approval, that the judge viewed this document from Angel Oak, decided that it said conditional, and said it's not granting Mr. Azzulli's claims because there is no evidence for a right to cure.
We talked a little bit about the trial court referencing exhibits A through L, not referencing exhibits M, N, or O, and opposing counsel seems to indicate that the reason is that your client's motion did not call the court's attention to those particular exhibits, did not direct the court's attention to those exhibits, and therefore the court was not required to consider them, as I understand the argument. What's your response to that?
So, Your Honor, first of all, appellee is the one that called the court's attention to the Angel Oak document submitted on May 14th. It was an appellant. They put the document in front of the judge and said, this is the last document CBAC received from Angel Oak. And plaintiff's opposition statement of fact does call out exhibit, I believe it's M and L, Your Honors. L being the email from Mr. Becker, specifically supporting his email saying that there was full loan approval without PTD conditions, and as well as the documents already submitted by appellees. To the extent that appellees are arguing that there were some admissions by appellant in this case, the admissions were that the documents they submitted were true and accurate. All these documents bear CBAC's bait stamps on it. These are not documents that appellant is producing. It's documents they are producing.
Counsel, did you have any luck finding the transcript site?
I did not, Your Honor. But if I could perhaps follow up with this court to confirm the matter. Both parties cited to it. I believe it's in the record. I'd like to follow up with this court.
You may file something.
Thank you.
Thank you for your arguments, counsel. We will take this matter under advisement and issue our decision in due course. We stand adjourned to set up for the next argument.